This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. We continue Tell Me More's look at New Orleans and the Gulf Coast today as we move closer to the five-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina's landfall. We're checking in on the dynamics between black and brown people especially, African Americans and Latinos. Later, we'll tell you about the passing of a civil rights icon, Mario Oblato, who once ran Jesse Jackson's National Rainbow Coalition and the League of United Latin American Citizens. But first, the Greater New Orleans Community Data Center says Katrina resulted in more than 1,400 deaths and the displacement of over a million Gulf Coast residents. The damage was almost incomprehensible and is still visible in many areas. With so much construction and reconstruction work needed, a great many Latino immigrants have been flooding into the city for the work, and that's led to a significant shift in demographics. To talk about it, we're joined by Gerard Stevens, program director of the local radio station WBOK, and Saket Soni, executive director of the New Orleans Worker Center for Racial Justice. They both speak with us from New Orleans. Welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Hello, thank you for having us.
Saket, let me start with you. What is the economic relationship between local blacks and the Latinos that have moved to the city?
Well, I would say that economically speaking, they are part of one community. I think it's very important to remember that 5 years ago, when Katrina made landfall and the levees were breached, hundreds of thousands of African-American workers and their families lost their jobs and their livelihoods, and they were excluded from return. They were displaced and effectively locked out of jobs in the reconstruction. Meanwhile, immigrant workers were brought in, included, but exploited. While one community was excluded and locked out, another community was exploited. And because of public policy, because of very divisive public policy and corporate practice in the last 5 years, there has been a sense of competition among these communities. These communities have found themselves pitted in some ways against each other. On the ground, however, as far as everyday economics of real life goes, I believe that they are part of one community, and that a closer look reveals a lot less competition and a lot more cooperation than one would think.
Gerard, your radio program takes calls mostly from African Americans. What have they been saying about the influx of Latinos into the city?
I can agree wholeheartedly with his previous statements, but I do think that there has been some discontent with the African American population, more so because of the fact that they were here before. And one thing that has been discussed is that the Latino population that has come into the city did some jobs that not necessarily African Americans or any other race wanted to do in the rebuilding process. So a big thank you went out to the Latino population in helping with the rebuilding of this city. I do think that what has been brought up and probably talked about more so is the number of jobs, the number of millions of dollars that have come into the city for the rebuilding population, rebuilding the population, and African Americans have been left out of the process. And who has been exploited is the Latino population, because they've come in, being brought in by a lot of, huge contractors that get these big federal contracts, bring in a Latino population that may be working for less just so they would have some income and also could be in the United States. And then after they do the work, maybe even exploited to the position of being called by immigration to deport them so they don't have to get paid.
Let me break in here, because I wonder if, I read that a lot of Latinos actually came to New Orleans right after the storm. People drove down there. People slept under bridges to get these jobs. So what would you say, Gerard, to the question is, are black people not just complaining? I mean, if they wanted these jobs, should they not be working harder to get them? And should they not be complaining now that they've been taken over by people that came to take them?
Well, I think that when a man, woman, whoever does a day's work, they deserve a decent pay and not have to go through the rigmarole of trying to see who's going to do it for less.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where there ended up being competition between the African-American population and the Latino population. It's funny that if the African-American population and the Latino population combined forces and became one, it would be much greater as a force than the two races fighting amongst each other to see who's going to get a job.
Since both of you think that, Saket, I wonder, why do you think there seems to be such tension between these two communities, and it's not just in New Orleans?
Well, I really agree with what Gerard said, and I think that the tension and the competition are really an outgrowth of the public policies and corporate practices that have created the world as it is. To give you an example, as a point of fact, many, many African-American residents and their families came home very heroically, even when the Bush administration didn't allow them to. They came home often in the middle of the night, often sneaking past National Guardsmen, and often crawling through fences to get home. They wanted nothing more than to rebuild their homes and rebuild their lives and livelihoods. Let's remember that days after Katrina, the federal government suspended the Davis-Bacon Act by executive order, meaning that they threw out prevailing wage in many industries, allowing the wages to plummet. And they
meaning just so we're clear, people didn't have to be paid at the federal minimum wage.
That's right. That's right. As a result of the suspension of a law called Davis-Bacon, workers no longer had to be paid the federal minimum wage in construction. And that allowed wages to fall through the bottom. The White House suspended affirmative action in contracting by executive order, meaning that hundreds and hundreds of African-American contractors, didn't get the contracts that they deserved to rebuild locally. It was in this context, as wages started falling through the floor and as locks and chains were put on the doors of public housing and the doors of contracts, while African-American families were locked out, immigrants were then recruited. Many of our members arrived to New Orleans and the Gulf Coast areas to work way below the minimum wage, face severe labor exploitation, and even found themselves in many cases in labor camps. So, when you talk about the men and women who came down while the federal government did nothing, the brave men and women who came down in cars to live under bridges and rebuild the city, those people were not treated with dignity and as human beings. They were considered disposable workers. And Gerard is right. When they finished their work and demanded to be paid, employers would call immigration and deport them.
I've got to jump in here because I need to make another couple of points. Gerard, you just did a live radio broadcast yesterday in the Lower Ninth Ward, and I was there a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of people I spoke to in that neighborhood think that this has all been deliberately done by the government to keep people of color from being able to work and come back.
There are so many issues in the Lower Ninth Ward. It's appalling, and even if you live in the city of New Orleans, if you don't go to the Lower Ninth Ward, you sometimes forget that the Lower Ninth Ward was the poster child for the flooding of New Orleans, why the millions of dollars poured in here in the first place. It was the photos and the video that we saw of the helicopters lifting people off of rooftops. That was the Lower Ninth Ward. On the other side of the Industrial Canal where the breach happened is the Lower Ninth Ward. So you would automatically think that the millions of dollars that poured in here from the federal government, from the state government, from the charities, from the people that did donations, that would be where the money would be more significant than any other part of the city. But that is not true. I did a Lower Ninth Ward broadcast yesterday morning, and honestly, I sat there and listened to the people, but I looked in their eyes to hear the pain, the suffering of trying to put together their structures, trying to put together their homes still, and it's been 5 years, And if you ride through the Lower Ninth Ward, which was one big significant issue, one man walked up to the microphone yesterday and said, you know, it's not that no one here knows. I got people that come from all across the country to do documentaries. We got people that come all across the country to do news reports. People even ride tour buses through our neighborhoods making a dollar bill on us. And we still don't have our homes together.
Sakit, let me ask you to give me a final thought because we're running against the clock. Sorry. But do you think this is a solvable problem between the blacks and Latinos? And I mean really short answer.
I think that poor and low-income African-Americans and poor and low-income Latinos and other immigrants unite around common ground and fight for economic justice, for fair housing, for inclusion and equity, then yes, I think that we can fix this and other problems and change the structure in which we live so that we can all have more prosperity.
Sakit Soni is the executive director of the New Orleans Workers Center for Racial Justice. Gerard Stevens is the program director of the local radio station WBOK. They joined us from New Orleans. Thank you, gentlemen, for your thoughts.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, the moms take on child discipline, the kind that's out in the open. But first, earlier this year, Education Secretary Arne Duncan, perhaps somewhat clumsily, called Hurricane Katrina the best thing that happened to the education system in New Orleans. In the aftermath of the storm, a state agency took over nearly every school in the city, and a wave of charters remade what was once one of the lowest performing districts in America. We're re-examining those changes just ahead of the fifth anniversary of the storm. NPR's education correspondent Larry Abramson is with me. He just got back from a visit to the city. Thanks for joining us, Larry.
Hi, Allison. How are you?
I'm great. So New Orleans is now basically the charter school of the U.S., right?
The charter school capital of the U.S., that's right. There's 61% of the schools in New Orleans are charter schools. Only Washington comes close to that, and they basically have half the number. So it's really become, you know, a laboratory. That term has been used a lot for different approaches to education. Lots of charter school operators basically want to have their finger in this pie, because the whole slate was wiped clean by the hurricane. And it's a chance for people to do things down there that they really can't do in other cities in the same way.
I think most people have the idea that charter school means better. Is that true for achievement?
You know, as far as achievement goes, really, there's no evidence in New Orleans that charter schools are doing any better than the traditional public schools. Of course, charter schools are public schools, but they're independently run. And they're doing about the same. There are a number of charter schools that are doing especially well. But the Recovery School District, which is the state-run school district, is also seeing huge achievement gains. Of course, it's easier to get achievement gains when you were doing terribly before. They only can go up. And so I think the real challenge for both the traditional public schools and the charter schools is as they start reaching, you know, average levels of achievement to other schools in the country, will they be able to continue these gains?
I heard from you talking about complaints you'd heard from people about the level of security in some of the schools. Is that affecting the achievement level? I mean, the kids that are being asked to walk along the lines, the security guards?
Well, you know, they really cracked down on security after the storm because there was a huge amount of upheaval. A lot of schools were opening in the middle of the year. There was a lot of chaos, obviously, in the city. And so
the security is a good thing, right?
So the security you would think was a good thing. But if you sort of militarize a lot of high schools, then you really are not going to help achievement. You're not going to help relationships between different neighborhoods that are sometimes sort of mixing in these schools. So there were a lot of complaints, I think, in the first few years of the reform effort that the crackdown was too severe. And the Recovery School District has rolled back. They pulled some of the security guards out of these schools. But at the same time, you know, I think a lot of people feel that there's evidence that really firm structure in some of these urban schools is necessary in order to boost achievement again among some of the lowest performing schools in the country. So you will see very, very stern discipline in some of these schools in a way you just don't experience it in other parts of the country.
Really briefly, has the takeover made it easier for everyone to get a better education because there was some disparity in the system before?
Well, you know, I think it's raised the floor. So I think the lowest performing schools were taken over and have been reformed and are really doing a lot better. But the highest performing schools are still overwhelmingly white. They have admission standards. They're very difficult to get into if you're not mobile, if you don't come from a background that's affluent and educated. So there's a lot of equity progress that needs to be made in order to make sure that everybody has access to all of the schools, which is what's supposed to be happening right now under the choice system, but doesn't entirely.
So model for the country or no?
You know, this is New Orleans is a weird city in every way, whether it's cuisine or music. And I think when it comes to education, the same is true. It's very difficult to imagine these reforms taking place in another city where you had an existing school system unless a hurricane happened to come through and wipe the slate clean.
NPR's education correspondent Larry Abramson, just back from a trip to New Orleans, joins us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you.
We spoke about discipline in New Orleans schools a few minutes ago. Let's talk about discipline in public now with our moms. Each week, Tell Me More visits with a diverse group of parents for their common sense parenting advice. Today, we're talking about a recent news story that many of us can relate to. It's a nightmare for many airline passengers. As soon as you wedge into a seat, a baby starts screaming. But on a recent Southwest Airlines flight, the mother of said screaming child allegedly smacked her 13-month-old toddler. Some reports say the mother hit the infant in the face. Others say it was a smack on the leg. But a flight attendant stepped in, took the baby from the mother, and called for help. The child was returned to her parents, but we wondered, when is it okay to intervene if you see a parent disciplining a child in what seems to be a questionable way? Joining us today to weigh in on this are regular parenting contributors, moms Jolene Ivey and Danny Tucker. They're here with me in our D.C. studios. Also joining us from his vacation is Dr. Charles Sophie. He's medical director for the Los Angeles County Department of Children and Family Services. He also has a private practice in adolescent and adult psychiatry. Welcome you all to the program.
Hey, Allison.
Hey, Allison.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Sophie, let me start with you, and we'll just kind of walk through a scenario. You're a parent, you're in public, and your kid does something that requires you to discipline them. And then someone who thinks they know a better way to do that steps in and tells you how to correct your child. How common is this?
Well, unfortunately, it's common, but that other parent stepping in should not be telling you how to do it. They should really be stepping in to see if you need some support, because clearly a parent is at the end of their rope as well. And I think that's the best way to enter one of those kinds of situations where you can be supportive and collaborative and help that parent out.
Jolene, has that ever happened to you? I mean, you've seen something that looks just a little egregious.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to say that although Dr. Sophie might be saying what should happen, what really happens, if you see somebody who you think is abusing a child, you don't go over and speak real sweetly. I mean, I've seen it happen where a woman was holding her baby, a baby small enough not to be able to crawl, I don't think, and was smacking that baby on the face. And I went over there and yelled at that woman and told her I was going to take that baby from her and I was going to put it in the car seat and take it home. But I just felt like, you know, her behavior was so off the chain. It was just like ridiculous. And I told her that how could she expect that baby to grow up and respect himself if she wasn't respecting the baby?
You're totally right. That's the thing, the fine line of discipline and abuse. And that's where the education for the general population has to be.
I'm interested, though, to see how the mother responded, because I can think of many scenarios where that might have gone south.
I am sure that I didn't handle it the best way possible, but it was a visceral reaction, and she was not real happy with me, but she did stop hitting the baby, at least in front of me. And it's not even like I miss never spanked your child. I mean, each one of mine, except for the babies, never been spanked.
And you have five boys.
I have five boys. One, two, three, and four have all gotten a spanking at some point, at least one. The baby never has, but he's only 10. There's always still time.
Danny, let me ask you, have you been that mom that's jumping in the middle?
Been on both sides. And as a young mother, when my son was young, and I snatched him up in a grocery store, I'll never forget it. But the mother that helped me was nice. She said, you know what, I understand what you're doing, but let's go to the bathroom and do that, because people that are looking, you may not understand. Because my son was just having a fit, and I snatched him up. I lost it. I was like, you know, I was a young mother. And on the other equation is, you know, I live in Ward 8, D.C., where we have a lot of single moms. And, you know, I've had to say something to them, the way they, especially the way they speak to their kids. But just like the mother that did to me, it's all in the way that you do it. I mean, I'm not going to go in there and correct this mother, make this mother feel like she's less of a mother because mm-hmm. I had to step in. You know, I just, like I say to some of the young women around the neighborhood, why don't I take her for you while you get it together? Because I know you don't really mean to talk to her like that. You know, I know you don't mean to cuss your child out like that. So it's all in how you know.
Were you affronted, though, that the person stepped to you in the first place? Did you feel like they were getting into something that wasn't their business?
I did, because I was, as we say, I was about to go on it. You know, but at the same time, I was going through something. I was, like I said, a young mother, and she basically diffused the situation.
Dr. Sophie, how do you tell the difference between a situation where if you do approach the mother, you're not perhaps placing the child in danger for later? Yeah, you always wonder if you say something to a mom in public, is a child then going to get in trouble later? How do you walk that line?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult, but the common things to know, as these women have said earlier, these are emotionally volatile situations. They're probably humiliating for both people watching, the child and the parent. The way you approach it is, are they really trying to discipline, or is it really crossing that line to abuse? Either way, you need to jump in to be able to get to that mother so she can hear you. If a mom can't hear you, she could run or she could react in a negative way. So it's kind of reaching in collaboratively, but also getting them to hear you, to feel safe enough to even relinquish that baby to you to hold till they calm down. Then you kind of got to make a friend with them to see if, you know, they do this at the home in their private place, or if they're the kind of woman who was just having a rough day. If you feel that this is a regular way of them dealing with things and they are harsh with their children, then you can follow them, get their license plate, call it into the child abuse hotline if you think so, or have the police alerted. But you'll feel that out in each situation. It's different, but you got to be able to enter it in a way that you're going to get that information back.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. Michelle Martin is away. We're talking to moms and a doctor about when it's appropriate to intervene when you see a child being disciplined in a questionable way. And doctor, to go back to our original story, the child in that story was 13 months old. What is appropriate discipline for a child that age?
I mean, discipline in general should be something that is going to teach your child, is going to train your child, prepare your child, those kinds of things. A balance between overall mutual respect and power, because your children are helpless, so they will shrink to that kind of stuff. So you got to really watch the tone of your voice and the way that the manner with which your body is held. So doing it in a powerful but respectful way is the way to do it. When you cross that line, either because you're a mom who just drug on 5 bags on an airplane or fought through a crowd, that child should not be paying the price for your inability to be, you know, not able to contain your anxiety and your feelings. If you really feel like you're pushing yourself, take a break. Ask somebody to help you, because you're pushing yourself to your limit, and then your child is going to pay, and you're going to be humiliated. And the worst part of it is your child learns that feeling and feels bad about themselves and then learns to do that themselves.
Danny, I want to ask you, where do you think that line is as a mom? Because we were talking earlier. I mean, there were some of us that were brought up, we were spanked. We did not get the time out in a corner, and it didn't seem to ruin us. Is there a place where you have to say, okay, honey, that's just a bad thing, and then the other time you do whatever?
Yeah, I think that's all in moderation. I think some people aren't spanking their kids enough, if you ask me. It's not illegal to spank your child. You know, like my father used to tell us, timeouts were for baseball games or football games. And, you know, timeout had nothing to do with a child. But that was the old school. That was the way they were raised. Now, I don't spank my kids nowhere like my parents did, and they didn't spank me like their parents did and so forth. So you get better at it. But there are times that calls for corporal punishment, and it's not illegal. You know, I mean, so you have to find that line. You know your child, and you know your child, and you know when they should be disciplining. So discipline them. We have a tendency, you know, all of a sudden to stop spanking. It's so bad for everybody. And when did that happen? Because there's a lot of kids out here, in my opinion, especially around our subways here in D.C., that need their hides, torn. They really do. Because this, you're just being rude, disrespectful, and if I was your mama, we gonna handle this.
And back in the old days, you could have.
You could, yes. But you know, we didn't have the same problems. You didn't see us on the bus and on the subways disrespecting people. I mean, these kids, some of these kids have been left to their own devices.
Dr. Sophie, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask the only doctor in the room, isn't it okay to spank your kids every now and then? Is it not?
Discipline can be done with some physicalness, as long as it's done with thoughtfulness, with love, and the intention only to instill an understanding into your child. You're not going to scream and yell and berate your child, because then there's no focus to that purpose. You need to be able to have a focus and a reason to be doing it. It has to be age appropriate. It has to be done without rage and intense anger. You know, the earlier you do it, the better. Always, I tell parents, parenting begins with you, the parent. If you're not solid and whole within yourself, then you're not going to raise a child who's solid and whole within themselves. So get yourself solid.
One thing we didn't get to talk about is it ever okay to discipline someone else's child? And I was at a burger place, and there were these two boys. They looked to be about 13 or 14, and they were saying some very inappropriate things, very loudly, bad language, all of that. And I just had to go over to them and said, look, that's it. Do you know that you would be embarrassing your family if they could see you now? You have to stop. And I got on their case, and they were so shocked, because I'm sure they look like the kind of kids that other people be afraid of. But what I saw was two kids that needed to be straightened out.
They were scared little kids inside. I just did it on the beach yesterday.
Oh, yeah? So it's
my
okay.
My 8-year-old, and there's a bunch of teenagers next to us with obscenities. And I looked at them, and I said, he can hear you, and I don't appreciate it. And I don't know if your parents would like that or if they allow it, but I don't want to be around it.
Let me ask you a question. If you are a person trying to discipline somebody else's kids and the kids jump back at you, what do? You just back off? I mean, I could see how some parents would be concerned about getting involved.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is those kids are doing it because, as I said earlier, they're pushing limits to see who's going to react and discipline them or give them some reaction. So you give it to them in a strong way, and then they back right down. You talk to them in a manner that doesn't have any wavering in your voice, and you're like, look, guys, cut it out. It's not cool. And walk away. They get it. They want that. They want somebody to tell them where the line is. They just are showing off because they're uncomfortable within their own skin. Their parents are afraid of them, but you're not, is what you want to show them.
I'm just going to ask one last question because we are running a little against the clock. But, Jolene, is there a time that you think it's okay to just tell somebody to butt out if some mother steps to you and says, how dare you treat your child that way? Is there a time that you could just say, yeah, this is none of your business, I have this?
Well, if I believe that they're wrong. I mean, sometimes if you're going off and you see that you're wrong, you really should accept that, yeah, you're right, I was wrong. But if the other parent is one of those parents who's a little too soft in your opinion, you might have to just say, excuse me, I've got this, you know, thank you for your opinion. Adios.
Dr. Sophie?
You can, but what you do is you do it in a reassuring way. Like, I see why you're upset, but listen, I got it under control. And you say back off in a very polite way. And you give them reassurance that they don't need to take your license plate number and call the police.
Thank you all for your insights and a very interesting conversation. Dr. Charles Sophie is the medical director for the Los Angeles County Department of Children and Family Services. And our regular moms, Jolene Ivey and Danny Tucker, joined me here in our studios in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Allison.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Remember at Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. And now we want to hear from you. Have you ever seen a parent disciplining their child in public? Did you get involved? What was the parent's reaction? And if you didn't, do you regret it? To tell us more, call our comment line at 202-842-3522. That's 202-842-3522. Or you can go to our website, go to npr.org, click on the Tell Me More page, and blog it out. I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. In just a few minutes, we look back at the life of an icon for Latino civil rights, Mario Oblado, who's died at the age of 78. But first, to matters of personal finance. A growing number of people of color, especially those with low incomes, live in a cash economy, no credit cards, not even a bank. They are what some might call the unbanked. The Wall Street Journal reports that 17 million people rely on alternative financial services such as check cashing, payday lenders, and prepaid debit cards that charge for each transaction. A Pew Health Group survey shows this emerging trend could represent the future of city centers, especially those with growing immigrant populations. Joining us to talk about this topic is Eleni Constantine, author of the study Unbanked by Choice, a look at how low-income Los Angeles households manage the money they earn. She's the director of the Financial Security Portfolio within the Pew Health Group. Also joining us from our New York Bureau is our money coach and someone who knows a bit about the topic at hand, Alvin Hall. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Eleni, let me start with you. Everyone says that these entities are really negative for building financial reserves. I mean, the check cashing stores, the payday lenders, this is really where the trend is going now?
Well, we see a large number of people in the unbanked bracket. And those of us who don't have a bank account have risks and lack of opportunities that people who have a bank account don't even think about. So the trend is dangerous. If you have a stash of cash under your mattress or in your pocket, you're obviously vulnerable to loss and attack. Plus, if you don't have a bank account and you use a check casher or a bill payment service, you're exposed to fraud, abusive practices, and price gouging because these entities aren't regulated the way a bank is. The Pew study found that the unbanked spend as much as $700 a year just to cash checks, that is, just to get their paycheck money.
And I just want to be clear, do the unbanked not use banking services at all, or do they use some banking services?
When we talk about the unbanked, we're talking about people who don't have a bank account. Some people live in the pure cash economy. Many people use non-bank transactional services like check cashers or bill payment, and these are the unregulated and potentially abusive providers.
Alvin, how significant is the cash economy for people of color, and what does it mean to people that don't do banks and therefore aren't building any credit?
It's huge for people of color. I know so many people here in New York and in Washington, D.C., as well as Florida, who never, ever pay for anything with credit cards or check. They always walk around with cash in their pockets. These people don't build much financial security for themselves. They typically don't save very much. They don't have good credit ratings or good credit reports, which, of course, today will affect your ability to get a job, since many of employers will check that now. It also affects your ability to think of yourself as someone who can build something for yourself, because you're used to managing your money day to day. Among people of color in particular, a lot of this arises, I think, from a historic distrust of the banks. In preparation for today's show, I talked to some friends of mine, family members who don't have bank accounts, mm-hmm. and they all talked about all of the nasty fees that they used to get hit with and they weren't aware of, how they didn't trust the people at the banks to tell them the truth. A lot of the same issues that came up in the Pew report. So I think for minority people and recent immigrants who don't have a knowledge of or access to a trustworthy person at a bank, this is a significant issue.
Eleni, talk to us about some of the disadvantages of not working through the mainstream banking system.
As Alvin said, if you don't have a bank account, not only are you exposed to all the risks that I just mentioned, but also you're not saving and you're not building credit. So you're not getting out of what I would call the subsistence farming mode of managing your money. That is, you may be getting by day to day, but you're not saving for your retirement, you're not saving to put your child through college. And not only that, but it's bad for the greater community because these people can't manage an emergency or, you know, get over a small financial bump. They become immediately dependent on the social support system.
So, and if there's an emergency or something, they have no wherewithal.
They have no savings, they have no credit card. You know, they manage day-to-day on their cash, and that's a tenuous existence.
Alvin, isn't this the way our grandparents used to do it? I mean, you didn't owe money, you paid your bills on time, you paid them with cash, and this was the right thing, but now it's not.
Now it's not, because the world is far more complicated, and we have different financial tools available to us. And also, the world is moving more and more toward credit cards and debit cards to reduce the criminal aspect of money. But I want to talk about something Eleni just mentioned, and that is the effect of when people are really outside of the economy. And this is something that I promised myself I was going to talk about today. My brother died recently, my youngest brother.
Sorry.
And he died completely destitute, completely and totally destitute. He had no money at all. And as a result, none of his brothers and sisters also had any money or credit cards. So I'm in New York City. They had to call me to get money to pay for the funeral. They had to get money to pay for the flowers, the transportation, everything. And I had to put it all on a credit card. They had no access to any finances when they really needed them. Imagine if somebody got sick. Would I get that call too? Probably.
Alvin, was his issue the same as yours? He just didn't trust the banks? He didn't feel like he needed them?
No, I actually trust the banks, but I'm in general, I don't trust banks when it comes to fees because I think they're dishonest about that.
Mm-hmm.
No, my brother just was one of these people who didn't use banks. He just did not think that having money in the bank gave him control of his money. If he got a paycheck, he went to an alternative financial service facility. And what did he do? He cashed a check and he carried all of the money in his pocket. Supposedly, he had just been paid when he died. When my sister arrived there, his wallet and all the money in it was gone.
Wow. Eleni, in your study, you found that a significant number of the unbanked were immigrants that are living below the poverty line, but they're sending a lot of money overseas to their families, are they not?
That's correct. We found that people who live in the cash economy, even though they're in this very low moderate income bracket, are remitting, sending money overseas more than people who are using alternative financial services. So that is, it appears that there's a choice. Either you spend those $700 a year to get your paycheck, or you can send them to your family.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Allison Keyes. Michelle Martin is away. We're talking about the record number of unbanked Americans estranged from mainstream banks with the Pew Health Group's Eleni Constantine. And joining us from our New York studios is our money coach, Alvin Hall. And I should emphasize, neither of our guests has ties to the banking or credit industries. Alvin, I want to come back to you. There's a pilot program that's out there right now that is set to encourage banks to create simple accounts with a $1 minimum balance and no overdraft fees.
Exactly.
Is this the kind of thing that's going to attract the people we've been talking about?
I think it is something they can deal with if the banks keep it simple. But, Allison, I don't trust the banks to keep it simple. For one reason, I think in today's world, everything turns on shareholder value.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of value am I delivering to the people who own the bank, who have shares in the bank? And they look at small and low-income people as people who they can use as sources of income. So it may start out simple and initially, but over time, it will grow more complicated.
And haven't the banks not traditionally promoted these kind of accounts because it doesn't make enough money for them?
That's right. About a decade ago, the U.S. Treasury started a whole campaign designed to get people, low-income people and poor people, to open bank accounts to become part of the larger financial system. But the banks dragged their feet about it. They said it was too difficult. People weren't interested. I think the banks need to be incentivized more to do something with that, but I'm not sure what those incentives would be. Clearly, profits would be an incentive, but you're not going to make a lot of money from poor or low-income people. So what about doing something for the good of the community?
Eleni, in your study, have you run across any ways that might help entice the unbanked to try a little trust in banking and see if it works for them?
Well, we looked at the reasons that people don't have a bank account. And the reason is very simple. The reason is they need to manage their money. They can't afford to have hidden fees. They can't afford surprises. They can't afford what most of us who have bank accounts live with every day, which is not knowing exactly how much money you have in your hand or
which
in your bank
maddening.
Account.
Which is maddening.
Right. Banks could do a much better job of making that transparent. They could show you when you made a purchase how much you had in your account at the point of sale. They could sequence your transactions chronologically so that you know, if you keep track of your transactions yourself, what's going in, what's coming out, just as you would if you had cash, but they don't. If you have a more simple account, perhaps that could be part of the structure of the account so that people could understand their accounts better.
Alvin, is there any way that you can think of to address the trust issue? Because if you have it, what does that say to the people that don't have your level of financial savvy?
I think that for low income and poor people and recent immigrants, having someone in the bank that they can talk to is really the key. That person should be sitting there explaining things to them. The person, when they have a problem, they actually have a face. It's hard to trust a bank when all you have standing in front of you is an ATM machine with buttons on it.
Alvin Hall is our regular contributor on Money Coach. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Eleni Constantine is the director of the Pew Health Group's financial security portfolio. She joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both for an insightful conversation.
You're welcome.
Earlier in the program, we talked about relations between African Americans and Latinos in New Orleans, but we want to wind up today remembering a civil rights giant who deftly bridged the gap between those communities. A great many Latinos knew him simply as Mario, in the same way African Americans know Jesse Jackson Sr. as Jesse. Mario Oblato was called the godfather of the Latino movement and fought hard against poor treatment of Latin American immigrants all the way back to his return to the U.S. from the Korean War. He co-founded what became known as the law firm of the Latino community called MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Here's former President Clinton in 1998 honoring Oblato with the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
As co-founder of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and the National Hispanic Bar Association, as chairman of the Rainbow Coalition, Mario Oblato has expanded opportunity for Americans of every race and ethnic background. Through the force of law and the power of the vote, he has enhanced the character and condition of America.
Mario Oblato later headed up several other civil and legal rights organizations, including serving as chair of Jesse Jackson's National Rainbow Coalition from 1989 to 1993. With me from her home near Los Angeles is Antonia Hernandez, a former MALDEF president and general counsel, now the president and CEO of the California Community Foundation. And from San Antonio, where Mario Oblato grew up, we're joined by Rosa Rosales, the immediate past national president of the civil rights group known as LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, which Mr. Oblato also led for a few years. Welcome both of you to the program.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Ms. Rosales, what did Mr. Oblato mean to Latinos in the United States?
Words cannot express what he meant to us. He was a hero. He was always there when there was a need for him to be there to defend the rights of Latinos. I remember him not only when he was president, but when he also continued to serve on the National Board of LULAC. And he was always bringing to us our attention all the issues that affect the Latinos. And he did it with a passion. You knew that he had a great heart. He made a great difference, and he will be an icon for us forever.
Ms. Rosales, especially in light of our earlier conversation about relations between blacks and Hispanics in New Orleans, how was it that he was able to bridge the gap between two communities that often have some issues with each other?
Well, that's what was so great about Mario, his ability to communicate. Regardless of whether you were black, whether you were Latino, he had this gift to be able to communicate and work together. You know, we all have our commonalities and we all have our differences, but Mario was a person that could work with everyone to ensure the best of everyone came out, and I think that was a gift that very few people have.
Ms. Hernandez, he served as Governor Jerry Brown's Secretary of Health and Welfare from 1975 to 1982 when he left to make a run for governor. We want to listen to a clip of him being, well, typically provocative in a telephone interview.
In 5 years, the Hispanics are going to be the majority population of the state.
You also made the statement that California is going to become a Hispanic state and that if anyone doesn't like it, they should leave. Did you say that?
I did. They ought to go back to Europe.
Ms. Hernandez clearly didn't pull many punches when it came to civil rights, did he?
No, Mario was unique in many ways. And one of the interesting things about Mario is that he always spoke his mind, but it was always in a very earnest way. And he spoke to the truth, and sometimes in a way that was not as diplomatic as one would hope.
I remember back when he was protesting against Taco Bell for the stereotypical Mexican accent of the Chihuahua. How did he do that? Was he a smooth negotiator there?
Well, you know, in that situation, like in all situations, his concern was the image of the Latino community. And I had a conversation with him once on this issue, and he was very clear. There were very few portrayals of Latinos on television, and they were all negative. And his perception was that until we changed
society's perception of Latinos, that we were going to be hampered in our ability to obtain our equal rights. And Mario was relentless. I met Mario in 1973.
Wow.
He was the president of Moldova, and I was a young law student. And what amazed me about Mario is his intelligence and his visionary, and he was a hard worker, I mean, relentless worker. And, you know, up till his last days, he never wavered from his commitment to civil rights and his commitment for advancing the rights of Latinos, but not exclusively. It was to place Latinos in our rightful place in society among many others. And he served as a guide to Latinos aspiring to serve the community and to serve this country. Specifically, I think his contributions in bridging, you know, sort of the relationship between communities, specifically the African American and Latino community, his organizing, you know, through LULAC of voters, and then within Moldova, the beginning of litigation under the Voting Rights Act to really establish our community as the force that it's becoming. Mario seeded a lot of that, and what you're seeing now is the fruition of a lot of what Mario planted. His seeds are growing.
Thank you, ladies, both. Antonio Hernandez is a former MALDEF president and general counsel. That's the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. She joined us from her home near Los Angeles. And Rosa Rosales, the past national president of LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, joined us from member station KSTX in San Antonio. Thank you both for your memories of such a civil rights icon.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
That's our program for today. I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.